steps. And real quick, before I start, I want to take a quick moment of silence. We lost somebody that some of you might know. If you don't, then...
Pray with us for a second.
A lot of you guys have heard my story already.
I'm just kidding, Irene.
Sorry. I'm not a product of my environment.
Okay, cool. Is this thing on? That thing's on. So I'm not a product of my environment, right? I've heard people say, you know, if you lived the life that I lived, you'd get loaded too. And that's not my story, man. I had a really good childhood. Like a really good childhood. No mental abuse, no physical abuse, no drug abuse in my house. My parents drank, but they were occasion drinkers. Like, we had the best New Year's parties, the best Halloween parties. They do like scavenger hunts and shit, and that's what it was like. They played softball, took me to the bars, me and my sister, and we kind of grew up in the bars. And that's just what it looked like. It looked like normal drinking. That's how my parents did it. You know, my dad, I later found out, smoked a little weed and did a little coke and ate some mushrooms, but he wasn't like me, which is weird. I'm positive. He ain't like me. So I grew up here. I played baseball as a kid, and I got good grades in school. And that's what I was going to be, a baseball player, man. That's what I was going to do with my life, right? And I played all through grade school, and I loved it, and I was good at it. I got good grades. I got into high school, and I got cut my freshman year. And I made it all the way up to the last cuts, and I got cut my freshman year. I gone on ski trips. When I get good grades in my house, we go on ski trips or we go to Disneyland and shit like that. That's how I grew up. So there's no reason I should have turned out the way I did, except for the fact I got this disease, right? So I get cut from the team and I don't know what to do, you know? So I hang out with the jocks, I go to the parties and I drink, I was like, oh, this is cool. It's a good time. By 16, and I'm going to kind of just get into the progression a little bit of this disease, because the disease is progressive, so is recovery. And you're going to kind of hopefully hear that in my story. So 16, I smoke weed for the first time. I'm like, hell yes, this is the shit. I'm doing this from now on. And sophomore year comes around and I try out for the team again. But, you know, I really don't put that much effort into it, because I'd rather go out and get stoned with the boys and hang out with the jocks at the parties. And by junior year, there's like 58 days in a school semester. And my junior year, I missed like 48 of them. So Washington High School asked me just not to come to school anymore. You know, I got kicked out. And my parents thought it was the neighborhood. Because I grew up on 23rd Missouri. They're like, oh, the neighborhood's getting bad. Let's move them up north. So I move up north and I go to North Canyon High School for my senior year. And the problem was, I found my people. And the friends that I made that year, I'm still friends with some of them today. You know, they're really good family friends. And they still get loaded. You know, they do a little cocaine on the weekends and then go to work. They smoke weed. They drink alcohol. And that's just what they do. But I kind of took it a little further, right? So my senior year, I drop out, right? Drop out, and I'm hanging out with my buddy. We turn 18. We're like, oh, where's the parties at, man? I'm bored. And we're like, oh, well, fucking school. We got to go to school to find out where the parties are. So we enroll ourselves back into school because we're 18 and we can do that. So I drop out my second senior year, right? So the way I partied with my friends is we'd load up a U-Haul full of alcohol, full of weed, full of everything we could find, and we'd take the U-Haul out to Castle Rock out in the desert, and we'd party, and, you know, the U-Haul may or may not make it back home. That's just how we did it. So I got with my friend. I was like, hey, dude, how are you? Because my friend would pay for all this shit. I was like, dude, how are you doing this? He's like, oh, I got these things called checks. I'm like, oh, dude, I got a checking account. I got a bank account. Let me get some of those checks. So 1996, picked up my first felony for forgery. They took me to Durango, and I figured out then at 18 that I didn't like jail. I just didn't like it. Spent some time in Durango and wasn't happy. I got through my probation and all that, and I decided I wasn't going to go back to jail for a while. I kind of held true for a little bit, but life goes on, it progresses, right? And I get this job at Circle K, and I meet hostage number one, and she's awesome. I'm stealing the beer, she's taking the money and the cigarettes, so it's like a match made in heaven. and I get her pregnant. I got to do the right thing, and so I get married. You know, we have a little boy in 98, and I get this job at McDonald's, right? And I go, I'm down there watching the video, and I come up looking all pitiful, and my wife and my best friend are there, and I looked at them, I said, I can do better than this, can't I? And they said, yeah. I said, all right, well, let's go home, get stoned, get a paper, and I'll get a real job. And I became an electrician that day. And I found a job as an electrician. I was like, oh, what a sweet gig. I can get stoned all day at work. I can drink after 12, because, you know, alcoholics, they drink in the morning. So we wait till noon to crack open a beer. I'm not an alcoholic, but I'll smoke weed all day at work. And so it just works out. You know, at this time, 18, 19 years old, whatever, eating a little bit of acid every once in a while is a good time, you know. Did some ecstasy. That was fun. Ate a lot of mushrooms. I like the hallucinogenics. You know, if you know potheads, because I'm a pothead with a meth problem. And if you know potheads and tweakers, they just don't get along, right? So that was the one thing I was never going to do. And, you know, cocaine was okay, but it started to get a little out of control. What happens is around, I think, 2002, my wife gets cancer. She gets leukemia, and she ends up dying. She left me with a little boy, and I don't know what to do. So I go to a party, and I meet hostage number two, because this chick's going to help me raise my kid, and it's going to be okay. And, you know, I got the ultimatum. You know, she didn't ask me to stop. She just asked me to slow down. You know, could you not do as much cocaine and drink as much as you're drinking? So I threw a beer at her head. That's how I answer those questions. You know? You must have had a beer thrown at your head if you're laughing. Or you've thrown the beer, right? So needless to say, she goes back to Illinois, and I get involved with the neighbor lady down the on the other side of the block, and methamphetamine's her drug of choice, right? And so, you know, by this time I'm doing way too much cocaine, and I'm selling it because, you know, I got to get mine for free. Barely going to work, you know, it was starting to get into a bad scene. And my helper comes over because I'm running a crew, and I got a helper, and he's a tweaker. And, you know, I got a lot of shit to do that day. I got to mow the lawn. I got to wash my car. I got to do laundry. I got to do a bunch of shit, and he's hitting the pipe, right? And so I hit a fucking meth pipe, and it was off to the races. That was it. Once that lady found out, it was on. All right, because meth was her drug of choice. So, methamphetamine cured my crack habit. I'll tell you that much. Did not do as much crack anymore. But nonetheless. So, you know, 2004, you know, I'm in this really sick relationship, and I end up getting this girl pregnant. In 2004, my second son's born, and the way I was there for that birth was, I'm downstairs at the hospital smoking crack in the car, and I run up. Is he here yet? Is he here yet? And she goes, no. I'm like, fuck. So I run back downstairs, and I got tired of running, and I seen over here there's a bathroom in the hospital room. I'm like, oh, well, fuck it, dude. I'll just smoke crack in there and wait. You know? So that's how I was there for that kid's birth, right? By this time, it's getting real bad, you know. Screaming, yelling, putting hands on people, fists through walls. Christmas trees are getting thrown out the front door. You know, it's an ugly scene. Domestic violence, picked up a couple more charges, some drug charges here and there, and it's just getting bad. You know, before all this even happened, I skipped something that's kind of pertinent. You guys ever have an intervention done on you? It's a fucked up deal. So, my mom, my sister, and my mom's best friend, now, they come and tell me when my son, right after my other girl left, before my other son was born, I got my son there and I'm trying to take care of him, and they wake me up in a cocaine alcohol induced hangover. My little boy is making himself a bowl of cereal, and they wake me up because my mom just walked in, and they do this intervention, and they decide to take my kid from me, and all I had to do was stay sober for a year and provide financial security enough to pay for him, and I could have him back. You know, she wouldn't call CPS. I could get him back. So, anyway, I'll get into that in a little while. So I have this other kid in a sick relationship, and I know they tell me to get help, and I get a big book, and I read it, spun out in the garage, probably after a suicide attempt. You know, I've had a couple of you guys ever have suicide attempts? Yeah, it's no good. You know, you're not really supposed to die when the rope breaks. You know, it's just kind of should have been a sign. You know, you get your stomach pumped a couple times. It's not a good scene. But the thought process was everybody would be better off if I wasn't here. And that was the thought process that I was in. And so I go try and get some help. 2005 was my first bout with recovery houses, halfway houses and stuff. And I go to this place called The Mission. And it's in Sunny Slope. And I get introduced to to the steps and all that. And, you know, baby's mom tells me, well, I'm pregnant again. So 2005, my daughter's born. And I wasn't there for that one because I was in a halfway house trying to get sober. And the mom wasn't. She was at home getting high with her sister and her mom. And so I caught a CPS case with that because my daughter came out with meth in her system. You know, so we had to go through CPS and all that. You know, time goes on. I'm in and out of halfway houses, you know, because I get bright ideas. Like maybe I can just smoke weed because I never fucked my life up that bad just smoking weed. And so I go try and do that, and I end up smoking meth again, right? And it just keeps getting worse every time I come back out, right? And what happens is in 2005, when I first came into these rooms, I'd met some people. You know, I'd seen some people around, and I'd go out, get loaded, I'd come back, and them fuckers were still here. You know, I go out and I get loaded and I come back, they were still here and their lives were getting better. So I knew it was going to work. I just didn't know if it was going to work for me. And, you know, baby's mom ends up getting sober. And what happens is, I don't even know, the timeline's just so blurred out. But at some point in time, I end up picking up the needle, right? And I'm shooting meth now, around 2008, 2009 or something. And it's just a real bad scene and I'm getting tired. You know, I'm getting tired, crashing on people's couches. I don't know. All I want is a pair of socks, you know, a pair of clean socks. You know, I'm collecting unemployment and they're taking child support out. So I get $120 a week to get loaded on. So I'm good for 2 days and I'll hook up a couple people and then I'm fucked for the rest of the week. And, it was just a tiresome life, man. Spent some time in bushes. There's a wash on Thunderbird and, by Barrows off of Thunderbird. There's a wash out there and I met some crazy cats out there, slept in the wash with them, traded dope. And it was just a bad scene, man. Stealing from my kids. You guys ever steal from your kids? It's fucked up, dude. Making my mom cry. Just all around dirtbag, dude. 2010, and I know it was 2010 because usually when you get kicked out of a halfway house, they put a duct tape sticker on your laundry basket or your laundry bag of the day that they kick you out. And it was November 27th, 2010. I got kicked out of the Denton house. So I know I was sober for a little bit in 2009. And what had happened was I got this job while I was at the Denton house. After the market tanked, I didn't do electrical work for a while, and I'm doing whatever I can, telemarketing crap. Man, they took the clocks down. Rat bastards. All right, cool. So anyway, so I get this job where I got to wear a suit and a tie and slacks and all this, and it's just not my style. You know, I'm bald because I'm going bald, but I'm a long hair. You know, it's just not my style. And I ride bikes. I don't know any tweakers here that ride bikes. Tweakers ride bikes? Right. Well, I'm hardcore. I ride a 20-inch, no gears, right? So I'm riding around a mile-long radius on Camelback and 19th Avenue to 7th Avenue and Indians are just around this building at Deerfield & Associates in a suit and tie, screaming at myself out loud about whether I should get high or go to work. And I turned into the guy on the corner screaming at himself. That's who I am when I get loaded. You know, so I finally make it to work and I go up to the boss. I'm like, look, man, I got a meth problem. I can't stop shooting meth and I need help. He goes, well, thanks for your honesty. You're fired. So, you know, by this time I'd weaseled my way back into baby's mom's house, you know, and I'd done it to my mom too until the cops, you know, they did a warrant sweep. So like 13, 14 of them are pulling me out of the house. But I weaseled my way back in baby's mom's house and, she answers the door with a piss cup. Fuck, dude. Once again, I had nowhere to go. Nowhere to go again. And I was tired. And so I went to this place. I knew people got sober there. You just had to look for them. It's called the You Can Too Club. You got to look for them, but they're there. And I hook up with this guy, and I said, I need a sponsor. And he suggests I go to Crossroads West. Now, oh, your stuff stopped recording. Didn't record anymore. Oh, I got half my story. That's right. Hey, Saturday night, I'm speaking at the Misfits. Tomorrow night. So anyway, right? So, all right, so I told you, huh, baby? I told my old lady I'm gonna switch podiums halfway through and fuck with everybody. So I'm at Crossroads West, right? And I didn't want to go to Crossroads West, you know, because, man, I've been to that Sunday meeting, and those people are sloppy, and I know who cleans up after them. It's the residents, And I don't want to do that shit, right? But by this time, I'm willing, dude. I was just so tired of the life I lived that I was willing to do anything. Mop those floors? Shit. All right. Wash those dishes? Shit. All right. I'll do anything. I just don't want to pick up and get loaded. You know, I got a crap job selling pens and magnets to business owners that don't need them. And I did that, and it made me angry. You know, I was getting spiritually sick at this job, and I was angry. But I was working steps, and I was doing everything that they said to do. And the book even suggests that I do it. It says the best way to get out of self is to be of service for someone else. You know, so I would get home from that job after being cussed out and angry, and I would wash the walls at Crossroads. You know, nobody asked me to do it, but I didn't want to pick up and get loaded. And I started doing that, you know, and crazy shit started to happen. Like, you know, I ended up getting laid off that job, and I walked over to the union hall, and I asked them if they needed electricians, and then I joined the electrical union. Crazy shit, you know, my kids, baby's mom would bring them up to Crossroads, and they would hang out in the grassy area and play wiffle ball with me. You know, my oldest, my mom would bring him by, and he would hang out, and we'd play baseball out there, you know. Weird shit would happen. I ended up getting that job as an electrician through the union, and I start working, and then they say, well, you should go to school, you know, get a journeyman card. I'm like, all right, cool. So I'm now a college student, and I'm in the apprenticeship program, and I'm going to graduate in May. You know, I went back to school. Crazy shit happened. You know, crazy shit happened. Like, my mom told me where she lived. And then gave me a key to her house. Crazy shit happens. You know, I get into some actual decent relationships in recovery. You know, a couple of them didn't end or didn't stay. They ended, but they didn't end like they normally do. You know, my relationships end like this. Shit getting thrown at me and cops getting called. That's how they end. Every time. You know, and these ones didn't end like that. And I learned how to have healthier relationships. I'm in a really good relationship right now. You know, I got a working relationship with my kids. So check it out. My oldest that my mom took, freshman year, I think, his freshman year, he was able to come back and live with me. You know, it didn't work out. He was there for about 6 months, and the dynamic was just not right. I had been 10 years out of his life. I didn't raise him, and it just wasn't working, and his grades were slipping, and we sat down and talked and said, hey, are you better off at grandma's? And he said, yeah, I think I am. So he went back to grandma's house. He graduated high school. He's in college now. You know, crazy shit happens. You know, I don't know. I get to have a good life. You know, I got to take him on skate park tours. I get to take him places. I get to do cool stuff. I get my little ones every other weekend, and they're at my house right now, playing on the trampoline and just palling around. I bring him to meetings with me. You might see him on Sundays with me. Just crazy stuff. My life got so much better. The bike I rolled up to Crossroads on, I recently got rid of, but I still had it. And I got a better one now that I used to race with the kids, and I blew my knee out, and I don't ride my bike anymore. But, you know, I got to enjoy that kind of stuff. I got working relationships with my mom and my dad again. You know, I've made some amends. So that's what happened. That's what it's like. It's now, I got a little time, right? All right, so I want to give an account of my experience through these steps, right? Because that's how all that shit happened. To going from the dirtbag person that I was, living on the streets, to the person that I am today, something happened, right? It wasn't that I just woke up one day and went, okay, I think I'm going to start doing good shit, because I've done that and said that, and it never worked out. I couldn't fucking do it. All right? I don't know how many times I got out of jail going, man, I ain't doing that again. Only to pick right back up and end up every time, right? So here's what happened, right? I go through the steps. My first step experience is that I'm fucked. I'm fucked, man. I'm going to pick up and get loaded. It's a matter of time. It says it right in the book. It says that I can't bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of a week or a month ago. I have no defense. None. I've lost the power of choice, right? And then they give an analogy. The analogy says that I lack the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. So all of us have a mental defense mechanism in our brain that says, don't touch a stove, it's hot, you're gonna get burned. And I've never touched a hot stove on purpose again. I might have slipped doing hot rails, but I've never, never on purpose touched a stove because something in my brain said, don't touch it, dummy, it's hot, you're gonna get burned. And I listened, that was my defense. The book says I lack that in respects to drugs and alcohol. Made perfect sense. That's why I do the things that I do. I can't remember how bad it was, or I'll downplay how bad it was. You know, living on the streets. Yeah, it's springtime. It's nice outside. Sitting in jail. Oh, I'm getting fed. Money on my books. It's not a big deal, right? My first step tells me I'm fucked. I'm gonna pick up and get loaded again. And that just doesn't go away. I wake up every morning like that. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. It's gonna happen, right? What's the trick? How do you get that shit not to happen? Right, so I move into my second step, and it said, you got to come to believe in a power greater than yourself, right? You got to find God. That's what the book said in chapter 4. It said, I got to find God. I didn't come here to find God, right? I got a bad taste in my mouth of what I think God is, and I want nothing to do with it. What it did was it enabled me to get in touch. It said, it told me I didn't have to believe in God to get this program. That's what it said in the doctor's, Bill's story. It said it in Bill's story. So it was only a matter of willing to believe that there's a power greater than myself. And I was willing to believe because I knew methamphetamine was a power greater than myself, so there had to be something good, right? Then it told me I could choose my own conception. I'm like, oh, I'm taking that literally, right? There's a Bugs Bunny cartoon, right? And it's got a big white Yeti, and he picks him up and says, I will love him and hug him and squeeze him, and I will call him George. My God's name's George. All right? That's my conception of what God is. And it's grown a little bit from there, but that's where it started, right? Step 3 said I had to turn my will and my life. You know, all that is my thoughts and my actions. If I turn my thoughts and my actions, if I think first of God, I'll act accordingly, right? If I think my own thoughts, I think sick thoughts and I act out on them. And that's what it is. I learned in the third step that I'm selfish and self-centered. That's my problem. I want what I want when I want it. And I can see it in my kids, some of them. Some of them might be just like me. God, I hope they don't pick up. But I could see it, you know, and that was the core root of my problem. Because I was selfish and self-centered, right? Get to my fourth step, and I learned a lot of shit in my fourth step, too. I learned that's where my character defects were, right? In my second step, I had to open my mind to all spiritual concepts. It told me that in the spiritual appendix in the back of the book. My mind is open to all spiritual concepts. You know, when back in the day when someone said Jesus or God or anything like that, I'm like, oh, fuck that. The seven deadly sins, oh, fuck that. Hit your knees to pray, oh, fuck that, right? But I don't want to get loaded, like real bad. I don't want to get loaded. So I'm going to open my mind a little bit. You know, and then what they did was they said, hitting your knees is just a sign of humility to that which you call God. I'm like, all right, cool, I'll do that. It started with that. All right, I get to my fourth step. I learn my character defects, and it said in the 12 and 12, it's the seven deadly sins. And I looked at them, right? Greed, I stole from my kids. I'm greedy, right? Sloth, I looked at that one. That's laziness. I don't have a beard because I think it looks cool. I'm fucking lazy. I don't want to shave. It's the truth, right? So I got some of them, all right, so I can accept that, right? Fourth step, I made out my three lists, my resentment list, my fears list, and my sexual inventory. And what I learned out of those was that had I not done the shit that I found out in the fourth column, I wouldn't be angry at all these fucking people, right? It wasn't all their fault. It was all my fault. All the shit that I'd done placed me in that position to be shit on, right? It was my fault. Fears, just tons of fears, right? Driven by 100 forms of fear. Sexual inventory. Found out what kind of person I am in regards to the opposite sex. A lot of times I'm a dirtbag, a liar, a cheat, and a thief. Right? Especially when I'm getting loaded. So I don't give a shit. But I learned how to have good, healthy relationships by not repeating the behavior. Because it asks silly questions like, what should you have done instead? Maybe I should have come home at a decent hour. You know, maybe I should have kept it in my pants that day. Whatever it is, I learned how to have a good, healthy relationship. Fifth step, I drop all that stuff, right? What happens is the fourth step doesn't feel too good because I feel like a piece of shit. And the fifth step, the freedom out of that fifth step is that I let it all go, right? That deep, dark secret. And it says it in the book. It doesn't say, what's your deep, dark secret? It says, time after time, newcomers tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives. That's the deep, dark secret. What am I taking to the grave? What am I not telling anybody? I told them. I told my sponsors. You know, I told a meeting at Maverick House. I was sharing in a meeting, and I got asked not to speak there anymore because I offended someone with my secret. So I don't tell that in meeting settings. But if I sponsor you, you know my secret. You know, and the reason you know that is because I'm about to ask you what yours is. You know, so I'm gonna tell you what mine is. It's got no power over me. It's not who I am today. Step 6 and 7, a paragraph and a prayer, right? Out of the big book, it's a paragraph and a prayer. It tells me to be willing, and it tells me to act in humility. The 12 and 12 goes a little deeper. It says, this is the step that separates the men from the boys. It means there's some deep shit in that sixth step, right? So I work a little bit just on identifying character defects, right? Nowhere in the book does it say, I work and remove my character defects. It doesn't say that. It says, God does that, right? Because when I identify them, I got a seven-step prayer. Once I know I'm acting out in the greed, lust, anger, envy, gluttony, sloth, whatever, pride, whatever it is, I can ask God to remove it, right? And he does. It might not be removed all day. I might have to ask him 20 times a day, you know, because I'm always trying to take my shit back. But that's how I get rid of it. And that's how it gets worked on, right? I become a better person that way. Step 8, it was just make a list. Step 8 in the 12 and 12, it defines the word harm. The definition of the word harm is to create physical, mental, emotional, or spiritual damage to somebody. Right? And I did a lot of that. You know, I'm writing out my 8th step, and I take from the 4th step, and I start putting it on there. But the 12 and 12 says we'd go a little further. You know, nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty, you know? And even if I didn't have a resentment, I might still owe something, right? And I thought about it. I was like, well, Famous Footwear. You know, I'm not mad at Famous Footwear. They weren't on my 4th step, but I redoubled my effort, went through my life, and I shopped for shoes like this. Take off my old ones, put them in the box, and walk out with new ones. Anybody else shop for shoes like that, or am I the only one? Right? So I owed them an amends. 9th step says I get to go out and repair this damage, and I start going out, right? I go to family first. Family loves me, right? I know they do. My grandpa had died, and so a lot of my family was together at one spot, and I start pulling them aside one by one. You know, this is what I did. How can I make it right to you? Is there anything else I've done to create harm? We just want what's good for you, and you keep doing what you're doing. There's a lot of stuff I got, right? I get to one of my uncles. He says, fuck you, see me in 5 years. Fuck, dude. Now, the book actually says that on our first approach, which entails I'm going to have to go back to some of these people, that was my experience, right? He gave me a time limit. So just real quick, what happened is 4 years and some change, I get invited to Christmas again. You know, it had been a while, and I got invited to Christmas, and it was at that uncle's house, and I go up to him. I said, look, I need to make this right. What can I do to make it right? He said, that's all I wanted was time enough for you to pull your head out of your ass to be a good father. Right? Because what happened was my ripple effect affected these aunts and uncles. I didn't do nothing to them. My ripple effect did something, right? And what they would hear is, oh, Jeremy's doing good. He's doing good. Fuck, he's in jail again. Oh, he's doing good. He's doing good. Oh, he's lost his kids and he's homeless again. Oh, he's doing good. He's doing good. No, sorry, he fell off again. Right? And all he wanted was for me to get a little time. That was all you wanted from me. I got a couple other amends stories, but I don't got time for that. So step 10, the directions in the book are continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, ask God at once to remove them. Discuss it with someone immediately. Make amends quickly if you've harmed anyone, and then resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others, right? The promises out of that 10th step are immense. Immense. It tells me that I'm going to be placed in a position of neutrality. I'll be safe and protected. The problem will be removed. It's removed. It's gone. Right? It's not my problem today. I got different problems. Right? So I try and practice that throughout my day. Throughout my day, I'm continuing to look for that stuff. Right? Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. And actually, if you read, it says when we retire at night, it just goes back through what I was doing in step 10 throughout my day. If I was looking, were we resentful? Or were we selfish? You know, do we owe an amends? Those are the questions that it asked, you know. But I wanted to go a little deeper because I didn't know nothing about prayer and meditation anyway. And my preconceived notion of what it was isn't what it was. You know, I thought meditation was you got to go, like, I'm not doing that. So what happened early in recovery, I got connected with a good group of guys. And this cat knew how to meditate. And we started up a meditation group. And we would sit quietly for 20 minutes. Focus on our breathing. Could you imagine 6-7 tweakers sitting quietly for 20 minutes? It took some practice. We weren't really good at first, but it got good. And I've got to do some pretty cool things with meditation. You know, I've sat with Buddhist monks at a monastery up on Cave Creek. I've been to Tibetan bowl meditations. I've been to gong meditation. The gong meditation made me angry. Like, really angry. I don't know what it was, but I wanted to choke the shit out of the little kid that was sitting next to me. And so I won't do a gong meditation again. Wasn't right. But I've been able to host meditations at my house. You know, I do in the summertime, I host a floating meditation where we float in my pool. And we just sit quietly and focus on our breathing for 20 minutes. You know, I've made some really good friends throughout some of this stuff. And it's been a pleasure. It's been a journey. I learned how to pray. You know, I hit my knees in the morning and I say my prayers, and it's a variation of the 3rd step prayer, because thank God for that book. It said the wording was optional. I don't have to say thee, thou, will, wah, wah. I could make it my own. That's what it said. And so I did. You know, I hit my knees. I said, God, please help keep me sober today. Guide and direct my thoughts and my actions. Let me live in your will. And I wake up and I go about my day. If it's a hard day, I hit my knees again in the middle of the day. I've done it on a job site a couple times. when I get home and I go to bed, I hit my knees again. I thank him. Just thanks. Thanks, man. Thanks for coming into my life. Thanks for me. Thanks for my kids. Thanks for this, that, and the other. And then please help the other sick and suffering alcoholics and drug addicts, right? Step 12, greatest promise in that book. Greatest promise in that book. It says, nothing will so much ensure immunity as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works, right? So my book, just, you know, it's rubber banded together, you know, because I go through it with another guy. This I think is what intensive work looks like. Right, just my book is shit, and I won't get a new one because it's got my notes. I get a new one. No, but it's because I'm constantly going through it. You know, I take guys through the steps at the halfway house I went through that helped save my life. I take them through the steps. I sponsor guys. I show up when people ask me to share. You know, I'm of service. I'm not only of service for this hour that I'm in this meeting. I get to be of service in my family life. You know, I get to be of service when mom needs help. Or a friend of mine needs help moving, you know. I'm not trying to find something that, what am I going to get out of it? You know, I want to go be helpful, you know. I get to pass that down to my kids. You know, my kids dig going out and making sandwiches for homeless. I've done that a couple times with them. You know, we get to do some really cool stuff. And I get to carry the message of hope. You know, that's what I get to carry. My past is an asset. What I did back then is not who I am today. That's just what I do when I get loaded. And that's not going to change, because I'm going to do that shit again if I pick up and get loaded, right? And the only way I found not to do that was to follow these simple steps. You know, follow them. Just do the best that I can. And I'm not perfect. I'm just not. But I got steps to help me through, right? What I've learned in this couple of years that I've actually stuck around was first three steps got me sober. 4 through 11 helped me become a better person. And step 12 is how I get to keep it. I get to keep it, right? And like I said, the life I get to have today is just, it's insane, the shit that I get to do. You know, people trust me with their houses. They trust me with their $30,000 machines because they invite me to go places. You know, I just got back from Glamis. I don't have a quad, you know. My brother-in-law does, though, and he trusts me to ride it with him. You know, my kids call me and want to come into my life. You know, they're happy when they see me. I don't have that... I don't have that sense of impending doom all day long. You know, I don't have that sense of that feeling of, God, life sucks and it's not going to get any better. I don't have that feeling of fuck, how am I going to do this again tomorrow? You know, I don't have that fear of, oh shit, I'm almost out of dope. You know, I don't have any of that shit hanging over my head. Like I said, I got a whole different set of problems today. And you'll hear them in the rooms. They call them luxury problems, you know, and it really is, you know, like, I don't even know. But it's insane. It's really cool. So I don't know if you're new. Stick around. It's going to get better. And the one thing I can promise is even if it doesn't get better, it'll get different. And different was better than what I had anyway. If you're back off a relapse, welcome back home, not dead. You know, and hopefully I get to be the guy that sticks around when someone that keeps relapsing goes, oh, that fucker's still here. Thank you, Tara, for still being here, right? So, yeah, fucking Bradley Brown. Thanks for not getting me killed out there, Bradley Brown. I appreciate it. Yeah, right? That's my story. I'm sticking to it. Thanks.